So now we're going to move to the fire season report. Doug?
Good afternoon, Chair. I'm some members of the board, State Forester Doherty. For the record, my name is Doug Graff. I serve as Chief of Fire Protection for the Department of Forestry. Today, we'll provide a closure fire season report before the board. Also, I'm very pleased to be here talking about this topic, as State Forester Doherty highlighted and lingered much through October, and we'll touch on that. I'd also take the opportunity in closing fire season, you know, share the standard data as expected acres burned, costs, numbers of fires. I'd like to fill in a few of the gaps based on conversations that we've had with the board on the updates throughout the season, some follow-up questions, specifically more detail on the understanding the acres protected by ODF as opposed to other acres. So we'll provide some clarity there based on reports throughout the season. And then also a safety follow-up. Specifically, how are we doing on the safety front based on additional exposure hours? So I want to report out there. Highlight engagement with the legislature, which is our next steps in terms of closing out the fire season financials for this fall. And then close with thoughts about next year. And I cringe. Board Member Cindy Deacon-Williams highlights folks counting down in Southwest. We do the same thing here in Salem, and I did cringe when I heard that article in the paper. We understand that fully. With that, we'll also tag it, leave in 10 minutes, so a 20-minute presentation as presented, and then leave some time for discussion or questions or clarity at the end, but certainly welcome along the way if there's any clarifying or specific questions. So specific to ODF protection, I often reference and will today ODF protected acres, cost, which is important as we speak with the legislature and we bring out full costs, and acres burn. And that is distinctly different than the statewide exposure. And throughout my conversations with the board, I always make that distinction clear. I wanted to start with a map to highlight that, especially with some new board members who may not be as familiar with this and certainly can follow up with more orientation. But at a high level, ODF operates and fire protection across 12 protective districts in the blue. They are all detailed, and it's forest land protection and grazing land within these forest protection districts that we have authority for fire protection. And that's about approximately 16 million acres of land that we protect, about 12 million acres of private lands, and 4 million acres of public lands that are assessed for fire protection. So we operate within those district boundaries of fire protection, and those are the numbers I'll be sharing. On the map, it's the white, and I'll speak specifically, we often refer to the checkerboard landscape. This is the BLM checkerboard landscape in Southwest Oregon, where we have about 2.2 million acres that we protect of BLM lands, previously through contract, now through agreement. Within our districts, you'll see the green colors there, and that's the Forest Service. When you look at forest land across the state of Oregon, approximately 30 million acres of forest land, of which we have protection responsibility on half, fire protection responsibility. The Forest Service has protection responsibility on their lands, the other 16 million acres. The board intersects in Southeast Oregon with the establishment of the Rangeland Protective Associations. It's approximately 5 million acres of private lands. And across these protective associations, these are volunteer groups, neighbors helping neighbors, and coordinating closely, as you can see, with BLM on the east side. So Bureau of Land Management has a lot of exposure here in the range and partners closely with those rangeland associations. We engage with the associations, one, through the board to establish them and support and training, and we have mutual aid agreements on our boundaries that will jointly fight fire alongside them when we have those boundary fights. Other jurisdictions, the tribal lands, national parks, only one in the state with Crater Lake, and Warm Springs Reservation, North Central Oregon. So certainly a complexity of jurisdictional responsibility on the landscape, and I think that's an important starting point to understand fire protection in the state of Oregon. Specific this year is this area in white. This is the North Central Oregon, and I've referenced this as the croplands, the wheat country in North Central Oregon, where we experienced 300,000 acres fire this year, and those are protected by the counties. So certainly complex. I will speak to all jurisdictions combined because that's what folks are really interested in at the end of the day, inclusive, including what ODF protects and we report out to the board under your authority, but statewide, what are the impacts? So I'll ensure that I make that distinction when we describe the data. Okay, next slide. Oh, it's in my hand. Fire season, we knew, and you all know, and Oregonians fully understand, another challenging fire season. This report, I will not belabor the specific fires. I'll speak to high level in my previous reports. Throughout the fire season, we talked in real time, current engagement on specific fires. But this is an indicator of what we lived through, certainly. The fire risk data from July, August, September, and through October. Interestingly, this is just your average October, so that was nice to see, but recognize underlying drought conditions. That fire season lingered through the end of October. We typically can see a season-ending event as early, sometimes as late September, but typically the first couple weeks of October. So I'd say we extended a couple weeks more than normal, and as State Forest Authority recognized, that doesn't mean all the fires go out. Looking at our 10-year data, we expect to have about 12 additional fires this year, calendar year. And we've already experienced one outside of fire season at 600 acres in eastern Oregon this last Sunday. So fire still, we will still be fighting fire through the winter months. Certainly the risk was there throughout fire season. As we described the full season, you've seen this slide before. And I just want to highlight it to sum up the season. Lightning-driven fires in three events, mid-June, mid-July, mid-August. Graham Fire was one of our first fires that we put incident management team on. This picture, and this is, I wanted to just highlight some of the technologies we have. Lightning data, so we know where the lightning strikes up, and we chase those down, but they really overwhelm the system, as we'll talk about a little bit more in the data. Here's the numbers of fires that were put on the landscape, particularly in Southwest Oregon, and the tune of approximately 120-plus fires over a 48-hour period, and it really overwhelms the protection system. In particular, the Klondike fires listed, there's, you know, we still have a Type 4, a small incident management team, on that fire. So certainly on the landscape throughout the season, I'll highlight that again on another slide. Mid-August, we certainly saw another push of lightning, and we had these fires also on the landscape then. The human-caused fires below, you see them singular, consistent throughout the year, certainly challenged us. And if you read the substation fire, Long Hollow, South Valley Road, Boxcot, a lot of these fires were in that North Central Oregon in the wheat country, and I highlighted that at a previous update with you.
I could just a second while you were on that.
Yeah.
Some of my opening comments about rainfall in Medford. We didn't have rain between June 21st and September 30th.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, we had one rain event that had a tenth of an inch.
Yep.
And it came with all the lightning strikes.
Yeah, all the indicators for this fire season, as we looked at our indicators, you know, we were peaking at some of the greatest risks historically that we've seen in different times and in different places across the state. So back to Peter's comments in terms of thanks under some really difficult conditions, the collective, all parties involved in fire protection, did an outstanding job under the conditions that we were at. I showed you this slide, and I do want to emphasize once again the importance of early detection in our portfolio in terms of a complete and coordinated fire protection system. At this date and time on August 17th, we did have the opportunity to have a military ship with forward-looking infrared technologies fly over Northeast Oregon following lightning events. And want to highlight on that day, we did find this fire, which was a small fire at less than 4 acres. However, we found 9 fires that we did not know were on the landscape under the smoke, undetected by the towers that we have in place with the cameras. That forward-looking infrared technology makes a difference. I just learned last week that the Forest Service on this same day also found a fire at 500 acres. So it's hard for me to grasp that we, on ODF protection, we have 9 fires burning that we're not aware of. One of them at 100 acres in size. Forest Service had one fire at 500 acres, and the smoke impacts come to play in a variety of different ways. Detection is one of those key pieces. And linking to the agency initiative, as we've discussed in the past, this is the technology we're looking at in terms of replacing the aircraft that we decommissioned the last couple of years after 37 years of service with these technologies. Early detection is significant. So let's close out on the data. We've talked through this on occasion, numbers of fires, acres burned, and cost. The blue is human-caused fires. The gray is lightning fires. We're about 113% over our 10-year average of 947 fires on ODF protection. So we're tracking a little higher than our 10-year average. Add the 10 or 12 that we're expecting through the next, a couple months. So we'll have a higher than normal number of fires on ODF protection. Hold the thought on human cause and lightning cause. I always highlight this every year. What drives our acres burned, which this slide highlights, is our lightning fires in gray. So interestingly enough, 2/3 of the fires across Oregon's jurisdictions are human caused. However, 80% of our acres burned are lightning caused. So going back to that system being overwhelmed with that lightning and the need and for early detection and immediate response, is critically important in minimizing acres.
I'm sorry to jump
in,
but we've been living it hard. One of the other things I think with the overwhelming of the multiple lightning strikes at the same time is that the human cause typically are in areas that are easily accessible.
Absolutely. There's quite a bit to that story, and I don't want to leave the impression that my eyes focus solely on lightning fires. Human-caused fires obviously play a critical role, and we need to put our full attention there also in terms of minimizing that risk. And that's the area we have some opportunity to be gained. In terms of cost, looking at gross costs, which is the blue line, we're again at one of the highest levels we've seen in our history, peaking over $102 million. When you receive reimbursements from FEMA fires, which we've had 6 FEMA-eligible fires, and reimbursements for other agency billings, we're at a net cost of $42 million. And at this point, I'd like to highlight this is what we're meeting with the legislature on. So required by law to report out on the nature and complexity of fire season and ultimately the cost. So before the legislature in our closing letter for fire season, we've requested $35 million of general fund to support the cost of fire season. We've already received $10 million from the Oregon Forest Land Protection Fund, which is the landowner dollars that support and help pay for large fire along with severity and at the base level of protection. So we'll be before the legislature in December with clarity and focus on recovering those dollars. We've also asked for an additional $14 million of other fund. So this is the other funding that we will get receivables from other agency billings or FEMA for those costs. We've already received $68 million in other fund authority from the legislature when we reported out this September an interim fire season report because we have to pay the bills of this effort. $102 million of effort in 2018 fire season within 45 days in receipt of those bills from folks who are on the ground, the contractors fighting those fires alongside landowners, operators, and agency personnel. I think also to recognize, and I'll link back to the board's work in the fire program review, this also within the recoveries and the difference between the gross costs and the net is the new BLM agreement, which is new and important for the board to recognize. Following the 2013 to 15 fire seasons, we initiated a fire program review that requested a review, an equitable review of the BLM contract specific to the finances. And we have an agreement in place for 1 year up and through June 30th of 2019. That recognizes and maintains the partnership at the base level of fire protection on those checkerboard landscapes. So one agency responding, we share in those base level costs to be ready to have the fire trucks, the engines, and the people for the fire bell when it rings. But large fire costs were removed from Oregon's fire protection system. And that is new, specific to BLM lands. So that's new for this year. So the recoveries, so the full, there's $20 million of recoveries here through the BLM that we would not have had by processing those finances. Also, because of that new arrangement, there's another $20 million that the BLM is financing directly through U.S. Forest Service because they're the financial institution, or CAL FIRE, specifically for the Klamathon fire that burned from California into Oregon. So we don't have the workload exposure to process that billing, and the state doesn't have the financial exposure with that new agreement. So bottom line, it's a $42 million reduction of the state's exposure with this new agreement that's transferred to the BLM based on that work falling 13 to 15. And that's significant dollars. I wanted the board to fully be aware and understand that, and we certainly have some follow-ups, but that was the work and direction from that fire program review. Now, that's a big gulp for BLM, and want to recognize maintaining their solvency is critically important in this conversation. So we certainly did not sever a partnership there. It's arranged differently, and we need to be standing beside BLM to ensure those dollars are there for closure and the complexity that that checkerboard landscapes brings to Oregon.
So if we were under the old BLM contract, how far would we have gone through the insurance policy this year?
Thank you, Peter. We would have gone through the insurance policy, absolutely. So we're at $42 million currently of net exposure. The deductible is $50 million. So add another $40 million, we're at $82 million. That's well past the insurance policy, $25 million, which we sense would certainly go away if we had a full exposure again, and an additional $15 million of general fund request on the table if that new orientation with the BLM was not in place this year. So definitely a significant topic, and didn't want that to surprise anyone on the board.
Thank you.
Of interest is House Bill 2501. A few sessions ago was added to the portfolio to the department to report out on the full cost of fire season to a degree. With specificity, we requested timber losses, private lands, grazing lands, number of livestock, structure value loss. So we do report out on this, and if the board was to look at our letters, I wanted some orientation for you to understand this component. It's not the full cost and loss that's experienced from wildfires, certainly, but it meets exactly what the House bill requested of the agency to report out annually, and you can see those costs and stumpage value, $60+ million loss is a significant portion in total, $62 million total. I really would highlight you know, that does not include the cost of evacuations, which we've had thousands of evacuations and businesses evacuated. We know Oregon Tourism did a study in 2017 that shows $52 million in losses from tourism in 2017. Significant portions of that in Southwest out of Ashland. We have the wheat field fire losses, you know, the agricultural losses with that amount of acres loss. How do you account for the loss of life that we experienced, fatality from a farmer respondent on the substation fire? And I often reference and have referenced in my report outs that often 10 times the cost of suppression can be the true costs. And there's a number of studies from the U.S. Department of Commerce, the National Institute of Standards and Technology, Western Forest Leadership Coalition, and Headwaters Economics, all put a range of 2 to 50 times the cost of suppression is the real cost of fire season. So I wanted to ensure the board that although represented as, the true cost of fire, there are other components within that that we don't simply have the capacity to acknowledge and come up with at an annual basis. But this is in our closing report to the legislature to meet the standards of the law. Smoke, as I mentioned, is certainly one of those impacts. This is the regional website I include in my links, in my report outs to the board throughout fire season, recognizing the challenges that smoke brings from wildfires. This is another link that we look at a national level, and you can see the impact from Northwest specifically, fires from Canada south to the border of Southern California. And the impacts were really significant in Southwest, specifically Klondike Fire is one of interest up and through October. And large fires on the landscape late into the season have certainly a challenge for us with east winds. And you can see this as a day of the activity picking up. And then the following day when that fire blew out the containment lines to the west, given that dry east wind event middle of October. And this is any firefighter in Oregon, particularly on the west side, one of the biggest fears and concerns. We saw these same type of fire impacts to a much greater degree with the Chetco Bar fire in 2017. I highlighted earlier the board requested some information, or there was a question of where do we stand in terms of the safety incidents. And I would highlight today that against our 10-year average in terms of ODF personnel to 2018, which is the DAC bars to the right, you can see clearly an increase across those months. This is certainly the claims you would expect those months to be the most challenging in terms of safety because of our exposure hours increase. I'll evolve this slide, and specifically I'll name you. Board Member Rose asked these questions, and I do appreciate this question, and my intent is to continue this slide and topic in our report outs through the fire season, because priority number one is to bring everybody home at the end of the day, and it's a good question of how we're doing here. The claim incidence rate is really the equalizer in terms of how well we're doing year to year. This is the claims, and we have experienced our highest in 2018. From the last 10 years. So the exposure hours certainly taken a toll, and this is a trend I feel like we really need to reverse. So certainly concerns me, and I appreciate Board Member Rose bringing that question before us at the last presentation. With that, I'll turn it to close. Deputy Chief Ron Graham was deployed to Florida, as State Forest already mentioned, that we have from folks supporting Florida, and then he'll take us home with some thoughts for next fight season.
Good afternoon, Chair Armisen, members of the board, and State Forester Daugherty. As Chief Graff mentioned, for the record, my name is Ron Graham, and I serve as the Deputy Chief of the Protection Division. Just to shift gears for you ever so slightly, as State Forester Daugherty mentioned in his opening remarks today, ODF was part of now three deployments to provide some hurricane response and relief in Florida. We do this for a couple of reasons. One, of course, the demand is there, the need is there. They're scrambling like many other areas, as we do in fire season, to find incident management teams to help manage these kind of activities, incidents when they happen. And as our fire season is winding down and the threat of large fires is somewhat diminished on our landscape, we're able to maintain our district drawdown and make sure we have our home front covered and provide this much-needed assistance to a state that repeatedly helps us during fire season. As was mentioned earlier, we had a Florida incident management team not only take over one of our fires, but then several other Florida resources here throughout the summer. So it was a great opportunity to give back, not on a fire, as State Forester Daugherty mentioned, but in another opportunity for another disaster. As Hurricane Michael made landfall on the 10th, the Office of Emergency Management was contacted through Florida through a process called the Emergency Management Assistance Compact. And basically, that's where one governor requests to another governor through their Office of Emergency Management this kind of assistance. The Office of State Fire Marshal put together an eight-person team, mobilized them immediately, and they were on the ground and taking over control in one county, Gulf County, Florida, by October 13th, so very soon after the hurricane made landfall. Shortly after, several other requests came in for more incident management teams. That's when ODF deployed two members, myself and one other employee, as part of a second Office of State Fire Marshal team, deployed to a neighboring county, immediately the adjacent West County to Gulf County, Bay County, which included Mexico Beach, which is the picture you see there on the screen, where basically the eye of the hurricane made landfall. Mexico Beach and Tyndall Air Force Base were some of the most heavily impacted areas. What you see on the screen is a little bit hard to see, but all of these streets in the running vertically here and all of these foundations that remain of what were once homes, and they're just completely destroyed, completely removed. A lot of it's back here in a debris field, several half mile to a mile away, and timber impacts. This storm ultimately impacted 11 counties throughout Florida and all the way through Georgia. Since the time that the joint team between the fire marshal and ODF mobilized, a second pure ODF team has mobilized as well. Their assignment is a little bit different. The first two teams supported the emergency operations centers in those two counties I mentioned, directly supporting a recovery efforts. There was still search and rescue going on. There was a lot of organization needed on the ground and the very beginnings of the recovery efforts. Since that time, the two teams and the third just deployed here Monday, another ODF team, their efforts are more to support the responders now. There's thousands of responders from both government sectors and private industry, public sectors, restoring power, cleaning up debris, feeding, sheltering, and caring for people. So that's their mission now, is to make sure that those responders actually have adequate base camps to work out of. So they're supporting several base camps across multiple counties as we speak. And there's likely to be, you know, years of ongoing effort needed there. I mentioned that it's a unique opportunity for us to give back in a situation where Florida gives to us often. It's also an opportunity for us to hone some skills and use some other skills that we don't normally use on wildfires that'll certainly benefit us through that training that we receive. Having to stretch our learning and capacity and use it in a different situation. So there is definitely a benefit coming home. It'll help us build capacity within our own incident management teams. And again, as I said, the demand is certainly there. All that being said, we have not taken our eye off our main focus or the ball, which is fire season, and do appreciate your comments, Board Member Williams, as far as counting down to the fire season, and we're watching it closely too, as you can see referenced by the current drought monitor. We're moving into conditions that most definitely follow 2015 drought conditions. Several Oregon counties, 11 counties, are under federal drought conditions, and 30-some counties are under state drought conditions. And you look across the west on the lower left little picture there, and you can see much of the west is building into those similar conditions as 2015. Oregon's definitely one of the harder hit states. The white on the map depicts normal conditions. Everything else is the deviation from normal. And the darker the red, the worse it is. So you can see the four corners. The southwest is in a pretty rough situation as well. And then, of course, we're sitting in pretty bad shape as well. So that's kind of the immediate picture. This takes us through October, tells us what we're dealing with. We've seen it play out in the lack of precipitation so far. And then we're also looking ahead towards fire season and looking at the big picture. And what you see in the top graphic is that there's a pretty strong likelihood that temperatures through the winter would be above normal for the next 3 months. And on the flip side, in the lower picture, that there is a somewhat strong chance that precipitation levels will be below normal. The white on the west side of the state indicates pretty equal chances of normal precipitation. So again, pretty significant departure coupled with what we went through this summer. We're keeping our eye on this, and it lines up to look a lot like another 2015-2018 fire season for us. So as we continue to work through this, again, it's been highlighted a couple times, but just want to call out all of our partners that did make us very successful in not only our initial attack. We're still running, as State Forester Daugherty said, around 95% successful initial attack, keeping fires 10 acres or less. And that includes everybody in the complete and coordinated system, our landowners, our contractors, the operators out there, the local, state, federal government partners, the tribes, everybody involved to bring that level of success to us in a very trying season. We were stretched in a lot of ways, but in a lot of ways, it was still a successful season and a safe season overall, despite some increases in our numbers of reportable accidents and injuries, as Chief Graff highlighted. With that, I would close and open it up to any questions from either of us.
And then,
questions or comments? Yeah, I just have a comment. I think you guys don't toot your own horn enough. You know, in Northeast Oregon and Central Oregon, some fantastic work got done with Severity Resources, and Doug talked about this at our association meeting. I think you guys don't talk about that enough. We had a lot of fire this year, obviously in Southeast or Southwest, but. What happened in Northeast, some extraordinary work was done, and especially Northeast and Central Oregon.
Thank you, Board Member Justice. I appreciate that, and we do have the opportunity to meet with the districts and share those. And I would highlight that the severity program is certainly a game changer, and it provides us with the ability to be flexible and responsive to the conditions on the landscape. We start the season off with 17 statewide aircraft, along with local contracting capacity, flexibility at our greatest time in need. And that's funded both with landowner dollars through the Oregon Forest Land Protection Fund and the general fund based on the 2013 Wildfire Protection Act.
I'm curious whether you guys have models with projections looking 10, 20 years into the future about what to expect and how that's fitting into your planning. I know the ones that I've seen for the Blue Mountain ecosystem are suggesting a lot more challenges in the future. You know, 600 to 700% increase in fire frequency and severity moving forward. And curious if you've got models that you have confidence in that you're using, and how we're fitting that into our plan, our forward planning.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the greatest work or the most recent work through Dr. Yost on staff, our ecologist in coordination with OSU, has been looking at future decades and what the range of possibility is. And it continues, as you mentioned, to look a little bit more dire across much of the state. So how do we react? And I think you see that expressed through the agency initiative in terms of diversifying our portfolio to be more on the proactive measure. Fire suppression obviously needs to be there, but the proactive, getting in front of that Increasing the pace and scale on federal lands is a component of that. And then as you look at where FIA's stat, 65% stat within the wildland-urban interface, our effort with wildland-urban interface forests is to engage our communities to be fire-adapted. And if you follow in the math, following the tenets of the cohesive strategy, response, fire-adapted communities, and resilient landscapes. So we're expanding the portfolio, if you will, very intentionally in recognizing that we think the challenge will continue to rise before us. And 2013 certainly has established that. And I do apologize. I spent some time preparing the board for statewide statistics, and I did not offer them up. So I will at this moment, in terms of an increasingly complex condition on the landscape. I showed you the slides, ODF protection, now that we have some more clarity around that, highlighted 76,000 acres burned statewide. We had 830,000 acres burned across all the jurisdictions when you add in the wheat country and the range in the east and the Forest Service and BLM tribes and PACs. On ODF protection, we have about 1,070 fires of the 1,900 fires statewide. And those numbers are pretty typical. We run about 50% ODF protection, about 50% of the fires on the landscape, with about 10% of the acres burned. And there's a lot of reasons for that, protecting in and around our communities in the wildland-urban interface. The range tends to have larger fires, and then new to the conversation, frankly, is the wheat fires of this year with 300,000 acres burned. And then costs for statewide all jurisdictions were just north of $500 million for suppression.
So it's building, I guess, on Neil's comments of, you know, if you looked several decades into the future, and that brings me kind of face to face with a discussion that is going to be extraordinarily uncomfortable, but I think we are obliged to at least start uncovering our eyes and looking that direction a little bit. And that is, I know we're currently, you know, maxing capacity pretty regularly on these years. We're looking for, you know, the pop to expand our capacity. But I am, frankly, fairly convinced that the challenge is going to exceed our ability to expand our capacity as we're looking decades into the future, which gets to then, you know, how do we respond and what do we do? And currently, our strategic, I guess our grand strategic approach to fire on the landscape is get it out quick, fast, and small when it's tiny, and then just dig in for the long haul thereafter on the stuff that gets away from us. And I'm wondering if we need to evaluate whether that is a feasible and reasonable and, frankly, achievable strategic approach into the future. And I don't think it is, and I think it might be worthwhile for us to open some of those uncomfortable conversations to try to explore what is tenable as a future expectation to have of our fire division.
So, first of all, I don't think it is our strategic approach. Our strategic okay. approach is tied to the a National Cohesive Wildfire Strategy, which is a three-prong approach, which is fire-adapted community, resilient landscapes, and effective and efficient response.
Yeah, what, so I was not talking that broadly. I was talking about in our strategic approach within fire suppression. You know, so we've got these other prongs of it. We want to have fire-adapted communities. We want to, you know, all that sort of thing. But I think our fire suppression challenge is going to grow faster than our fire suppression capabilities.
And I don't disagree with you. And when we looked at when Andrew Yost presented the model several years back, you know, the only thing that he was wrong on was how fast it was going to hit us.
Yeah.
And so
yeah.
we were already where we thought we were going to be 10 years from now.
Right.
So the challenge here, and it's, you know, if you got a better idea of how to solve this, I will be grateful. Yeah. But the challenge is it's always easy to get people to spend money for disasters while they're happening. So, you know, we just spent $100 million. Nobody blinked. It's net $41 million. They'll give us that money. But if we go ask for just say $5 million to do something proactive, it's, you know, we would have to do a justification, you know, 10 pay, you know, whatever. And it'll be questionable whether we get it. Then they'll say, you know exactly what you're doing. So it's just been a historic problem. This isn't a problem that crept up on us a year ago. This is a problem that's been creeping us on us for over 20 years. And we've been talking, and it's back in the Ecological Restoration Institute in Arizona has been talking about this issue for over 20 years and beginning to proactively invest. So when
Peter, that's I understand. That's actually not where I was going. And I understand the realities and the difficulties of trying to get folks to respond and act when the disaster's not upon them. So I was not talking about this strategic comprehensive approach. I was talking specifically just within the range of fire suppression, even with our added POP that will increase our militia capabilities. I foresee our fire suppression demands exceeding our capacity to respond. And so I think we need to hold some of those really hard, nasty discussions of what happens if we find ourselves in a situation where there's more fires on the ground than we've got capacity to respond to. And what do we have? Do we have a framework for dealing with that eventuality? And do we need to revisit that framework in light of what we're looking at coming at us in the coming decades? And I know it's not something that's unaddressed at the moment. I'm just thinking we're going to
maybe I can just I can jump in a little bit there. I mean, yeah. I appreciate what you're saying. I would just say in Northeast Oregon, ODF is working really closely with NRCS and the Forest Service, looking at landscape analysis that is trying to prioritize where we do treatment on both the public and private land, and beginning to build both the analytical framework and the social license for wildland fire use. And I mean, I think that's the direction we need to go. I think collectively we need to keep raising our voices, the board, and build a strong coalition to get the money that is needed to invest in the restoration work that is required to begin to reduce the risk that we're looking at going into the future.
Yep, and I agree with all of that, and I think that's happening down in Southwest as well. But I guess I see a fairly long lead time in our ability to get out and do the restoration work that we're talking about that would actually have an impact on landscape scale fire behavior and the reality of the changing fire climate that we're operating under. And so even if everything goes as perfectly as it could possibly go in terms of changing our land use planning so that we're not having as many problems in the urban interface as we are now and not increasing our urban interface problems as we expand and push our urban boundaries out into the wildlands. You know, even if everything on that end goes as well as it can, I would imagine our challenge on suppression is going to exceed our capacity to respond pretty soon. And I think we've got, you know, I think we've got to grapple with it right now. And even though we've got I think if we don't start grappling with it now, I think we will find ourselves in a bind pretty quickly. Even though we've got this natural response that when there's a disaster, the purse springs tend to open and we get more money to cover our costs, there is a limit to that. And no matter how rapidly we go out and try to do our adaptive management in terms of human interface, urban wildland interface, or in terms of going out and doing thinning and restoration in the wildlands to reduce fire risk, we're still, I think, going to see the challenge for suppression exceed our capacity to respond. And if that's a foreseeable thing, I think it's worthwhile to hold some discussions about how we're going to deal with that reality.
Well, yeah, and I mean, I think we've seen that every year over the past 5 years when we get into PL5, there are fires that we don't send resources to, and yep. we have to make those challenging decisions, and yeah. they don't always work out, such as a,
and so we've been doing those, you've been doing those, having to make those decisions, and some of them have worked and some of them haven't, but do we need to revisit that, and is it worth having a board discussion on that or not?
I also, I mean, I think that we may, you know, we base our attitude about, you know, how much money we can get out of the legislature on past history and how hard that is to do. But given years like this and the number of Oregonians affected for so long with smoke and those directly affected where Cindy lives by fire, I hope we don't underestimate, you know, the changes in public opinion that would lead to more support, you know, legislatively and for maybe, you know, for more infrastructure, for more equipment and all to deal some of what with Cindy is talking about. And I think, you know, there's no guarantees, but I think we got to test those waters more aggressively as we go forward the next few years.
So down in my county, for instance, the county is looking at putting up some money to secure some additional aerial support.
Right.
Because they want to have it on hand, dedicated and committed to our area. You know, there's lots of approaches, but it seems to me like we know the challenge is there. It might be worth doing it, having a conversation about how we might promote our ability to deal with what is a logical and foreseeable future.
Well, and
outside of the fire season, where you're having to make the decisions then when you've got a crisis to respond to.
Well, and I think we did that with the fire program review and the Secretary of State audit. And I think we actually have a fairly bold ask. I think it's, what is it, 27 million and yep. 55 people. And so this should be the year that that would be
we shall see.
Funded, you know, in theory. But we're all,
see.
Yeah, yep. we're also facing a $100 million gap between our current service level for providing standard services before we make any enhancement. So, you know, I do think we are thinking strategically. We spent a lot of time developing our strategic initiative about how we respond to the immediate problem. I think there is a longer term conversation that we do need to have as a state about where we want our forest in 20 years. Around what conditions they should be in, and where do we prioritize limited resources to begin moving in that direction. And I don't think we, you know, we're making good strides where we can, particularly based on local willingness to do treatments with our good neighbor authority and our federal forest restoration. But I do think we need to start having a strategic discussion about that. I think we also need to start talking about public and private infrastructure public and private partnerships to build infrastructures in rural communities to make it more cost effective to do treatments. But I think there's a longer conversation the state needs to have about what direction we're going.
And what I was asking for.
Obviously, there's more to talk about. And now we'll actually, not necessarily on this particular topic, but get some better understanding of how public attitudes around forestry issues. It's a nice subtle segue to moving on because we're running late. Thank you both very much.